Our next speaker is Andrew Schlafly. Not only has he and his famous family done incredible things for the conservative movement, but whenever Jane or people on our side of the issue need to speak with an honest lawyer, we always have, and that's not easy to find, you know. Whenever you want to speak with an honest lawyer who is also a very skilled lawyer, which is even more difficult to find, honesty is kind of a disadvantage in that profession. We've always had the advantage of being able to speak with this outstanding man. He's helped everybody around working on the things that all of us share in innumerable ways through the years. So it's a pleasure to have him as a speaker, and also because of the many ways he's helped us all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's great being here. The legal profession deserves a lot of blame, that's for sure. However, to some extent, the legal profession really reflects the values of society as a whole. And I was once at a dinner, no kidding, where one person said to me he's looking for an honest attorney, and then he was quickly corrected by the one next to him who said, no, I'm looking for a good attorney. I don't want an honest attorney. I want a good attorney who's going to do the best for me. So what can you do? I learned how to use the heat out here to my advantage this weekend. At one point, I was stranded several miles from this hotel, and I wanted to get back to the conference as quickly as possible. And I struck up a conversation with a friendly couple, and I thought, how am I going to get this couple to give me a ride to this hotel? I explained how I was at a conference here and so on. And finally, I thought of how to do it. I asked the couple, I said, do you think it's too hot to walk several miles to this hotel? And then I waited. I waited for the response. And they said, oh, do you need a ride? Well, we've had some terrific presentations this weekend on energy and other resources. But how about our greatest resource of all? What would that be? Oil? No, I don't think so. People, or intelligence, brains, great thinkers, developing the great thinkers of our society, the people who will have the insights that will generate wealth in the future. That's really our greatest resource. And if we gave as much thought into how to develop that greatest resource, our society would be much better off, don't you think? Well, this has happened to me by happenstance that I've stumbled into this issue, and it's about 6 years ago, I started teaching homeschoolers and did it kind of as a hobby, kind of as a charitable thing to do. I do charge them, but I don't make enough money to cover for my time. And I've learned some things about homeschoolers, and some of the more obvious things that I've learned before I get into the topic of this talk is that homeschoolers tend to be happier. They tend to smile more. They tend to be healthier. They tend to have less obesity. They tend to dress in a more straightforward manner than people who go to our school system. They tend to be friendlier to strangers. They tend to strike up a conversation more easily with people they don't know. There are fewer cliques, tend to exclude people less. They tend to be on less medication, tend to be less anxiety among homeschoolers, less addiction. I've taught 145 homeschool teenagers. I don't think a single one of them had taken up smoking, for example. Tends to be less addiction among homeschoolers. Less profanity. Rarely hear them use profanity. Here's an interesting one. The homeschool community tends to be friendlier to adoption. A relatively high percentage of the students I've taught in homeschooling were adopted. I didn't encounter that when I grew up in the school system, as many adopted children. I think it's great. I think it's a very healthy environment to have a lot of adopted children. Here's another interesting thing. Homeschool students tend to vote in a far higher percentage than people who went through our school system when they reach voting age. Almost three times as high a voting rate by homeschoolers when they reach 18 than by people who have been through our school system. So these are all characteristics that I've noticed to the point where I can almost pick out a homeschooler compared to someone who's in our school system just by looking at them, just by looking at their demeanor, looking at how they dress and how they behave and so on. You can almost detect the the distinction just by viewing them. But that's not the topic of my talk. And we might say, what do we really care how teenagers dress? It's not as weighty an issue as global warming and these other great matters that face us. But I think we do care whether our society is developing great thinkers, or we should care. We don't hear many people talk about that, but we should care, because that is our most important resource. We care about having a U.S. Constitution and the insight that was behind that. We care about having light bulbs and that somebody had the insight to invent a light bulb and that our society developed someone who would have that insight and bring that marvelous invention to us. We do care about having people who can provide the mathematical proofs, who can break the codes of our enemies, and so on. We do care about having the Gospel of John, that someone was able to write that marvelous book. We do care about having the Gettysburg Address. So it is important to us that we develop great thinkers. And perhaps that's even more important than the average intelligence of our society, is that our society has a way to develop the extraordinary insights and the astounding moments of brilliance that can then benefit all of us. What qualities would we find to be essential to promote the development of a great thinker? What would we look for? What would we say are essential for someone to be a great thinker? I use the word thinker broadly. In other words, an invention and other sort of great contributions. Well, I've listed four, and you all may have some additional suggestions, and I'll open it up for questions afterwards. But I would list number one in terms of the quality we need to inculcate to develop a great thinker: open-mindedness. Great thinker has to be open-minded, has to be willing to go a different path, has to be willing to think in a different way, has to be willing to step apart from the crowd in order to make that great contribution. The second quality I would consider to be very important in developing a great thinker or someone who's going to have a great insight is a person has to be a self-starter. The person can't be someone who simply takes orders well and does what he's told. He's got to be able to show initiative, he or she, and have that self-motivating ability, the ability to step above and beyond where anyone has stepped before. Number three, I would say it's essential that the person have an absence of misleading propaganda, not someone who has not been misled in so many ways that the person is going to be spending a lifetime trying to straighten that out. It's got to be someone whose mind is clear enough and free from sort of the pollution that's going to mislead that person for most of his or her productive years. And number four, I would say the person has to have time and energy at a relatively young age to develop the skills that are necessary to become a great thinker. And at one point, I listed a lot of the great works of literature or great mathematical proofs and so on, and almost all were done by people at a fairly young age. People 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. You look at Isaac Newton. When did he have his great insights? I think he was maybe 23 years old. Moby Dick, when was that written? It was in Herman Melville's early 20s. Great mathematical proofs. Kurt Gödel, when did he have his insight? One of the greatest mathematical insights of the 21st century. It's when he was a teenager, and so on. These marvelous insights come when you're young. And that's not an excuse as we get older, but it's the reality. Mathematicians, they say that a mathematician invariably does his greatest work before he's 25. And you can go right down the list, and it's true in almost every single case. And it's true in a lot of other fields, too. And so the person has to have the time and energy to be able to develop the skill that he or she has at a young age. Can't be so busy with other things or exhausted or whatever that the person can't develop this great talent that he has. So those are the four ways, all four I would say are essential to developing a great thinker: open-mindedness, self-starter, absence of being misled, and the time and energy at a young age. Now, homeschooling develops all four of those, and really only homeschooling does. The school system does not develop those four essential qualities. It just doesn't. Just to take one example, if you look at how we develop mathematicians today, you go through college, you go through graduate school, you get your PhD, you're already 25 in our system for developing mathematicians before you're ready to do your original work. Maybe you do it as part of your PhD, so maybe you're 23 when you start to think on your own, but pretty much you're sort of regurgitating, learning techniques by others until you're nearly 25. And then our system says, okay, go to it. Have your great insight. Well, historically, that's too late. You're past your best years as a mathematician. So it's a crazy system for developing great mathematicians. But you look at homeschooling, you've got that time when you're 15, 16, 17. You start to develop, hey, this kid's got some great mathematical skills. Let's start seeing what this child can do. And that homeschooler can reach great heights at an early age when he has the maximum chance of doing so. All right, let's go to examples. I started to develop a list of prominent people who were homeschooled, and I was amazed at some of the names who pop up as having been homeschooled. These people who made these great contributions to our society in many different ways, you say, oh my gosh, I didn't know that person was homeschooled. And I have it alphabetical here, and let's just go right into it. Ansel Adams, the greatest landscape photographer of the 20th century. He was homeschooled. Quote, at 12, unable to stand the confinement and tedium of the classroom, he utterly disrupted his lessons with wild laughter and undisguised contempt for the inept ramblings of his teachers. His father decided that Ansel's formal education was best ended. And from that point forward, the boy was homeschooled in Greek, the English classics, algebra, and the glories of the ocean, inlets, and rocky beaches that surrounded their home very near San Francisco. And he went on to be the marvelous photographer, and I'm sure many of you have seen his photos and so on. Homeschool. John Adams, second U.S. president, learned to read at home and was then taught in the kitchen by a neighbor with a handful of children. He matriculated to Harvard College at age 15. Louisa May Alcott, the author of Little Women and other great works, was taught at home by her father. Benjamin Banneker, who wrote the first almanac by a black man and helped survey Washington, D.C., taught to read and write by his grandmother in rural Maryland. Clara Barton, founder of the American Association of the International Red Cross, homeschooled. Alexander Graham Bell, inventor of the telephone. His deaf mother taught him to read and write, and he returned the favor by inventing the telephone to try to help her communicate. And we get the marvelous invention of the telephone. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Christian in Nazi Germany, who spoke against Hitler and was martyred for doing so. All these were homeschooled. How about this one? William Jennings Bryan, one of the greatest orators in American political history. Some would say he's the founder of the modern Democratic Party. He was a Secretary of State under President Woodrow Wilson and probably the only Secretary of State who resigned based purely on principle because he was against World War I. He was homeschooled. He was homeschooled until age 10 as his mother taught him to stand on a table to recite his lessons. William F. Buckley was homeschooled for part of his time, the great conservative intellectual. Andrew Carnegie, George Washington Carver. Then we get into the C's. We have some mathematicians here. Augustine Louis Cauchy, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, was taught by his father during an 11-year retreat to the country to escape the French Revolution. His father wrote his own textbooks, several of them in the fluent verse of which he was master. Verse, he believed, made grammar, history, and above all morals less repulsive to the juvenile mind. Chebyshev, one of the greatest Russian mathematicians, was homeschooled until college. In fact, I found that nearly every great modern mathematician was homeschooled. That it's hard, actually, to find great mathematicians who were not homeschooled. Now, you may be thinking, well, wait a minute. This was true in the old days before we had this marvelous modern public school system, and you're citing these examples from the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. I mean, this is fuddy-duddy stuff. They don't do that anymore. I mean, come on. The greatest mathematicians today, surely they went to our finest schools and so on. No, not really. The person who holds the record as the greatest contest mathematician, Reed Barton. This fellow scored in the top five in the nation in the Putnam exam every time he took it. Now, the Putnam exam, if you don't know what that is the most difficult math contest that's given to the very top mathematicians in colleges. And I took it once as a freshman, and it's like out of a scale of like 60, and I think I got like 6 points out of 60, and I said, okay, that's enough for me. Move on to something else. Perfect score by Reed Barton several times on this, and every time he took it, he was in the top five in the country. In fact, he has the greatest record of anybody in math competitions ever. And this is current. He's getting his PhD now, or he just got his PhD. He was homeschooled. In fact, the leading mathematician at Harvard today, who is going to become a junior this year, he was homeschooled. There is another mathematician today, a math prodigy taken by Princeton University, Ari Israel, quote, never attended a regular school. His parents homeschooled both him and his older sister, Rachel, allowing them to work at their own pace and discover their own interests. His dad, Benjamin, a computer programmer, helped him with math and science, while his mom, Rebecca, taught him English and history. Princeton University right now. So now, wait a minute. So now, most of the great mathematicians were homeschooled. Well, that's not very many people, but that is very important to our society. Do we want to shut that off? Do we want to ignore that? Is this something that we should discourage, or is this something we should encourage? Sounds like it's something we should encourage, because we all benefit when these great thinkers reach the maximum of their potential. Agatha Christie, we're into the seas here, best-selling English mystery writer. She was homeschooled by her mother. Winston Churchill, British statesman. It was at home he was taught how to read, write, and do math, and was not enrolled in a school until several months into the school year at the age of 7. And even then, after 2 years at school, he was abruptly pulled out, and then spent several years under the instruction of 2 maiden sisters in a less formal school setting. And that gives him the open-mindedness. That gives him the independence. That gives him the ability to become great contributors to society. They're not like sheep in a school setting. Charles Dickens, homeschool. Then we get to Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison was in third grade, and his teacher thought that Thomas Edison was an idiot. And his mother, Thomas Edison's mother, had a different opinion of him. And she pulled him out of school, and he never went back. And Thomas Edison was homeschooled. And look at the marvelous insights all of our society has because Thomas Edison was homeschooled. Had he not been homeschooled, had he gone through that school system and repeatedly been branded as an idiot, humiliated, teased, depressed, we probably never would have gotten that. The light bulb, the phonograph, the motion pictures, over 1,000 inventions Thomas Edison created. Paul Erdos, most prolific mathematician of the 20th century, taught at home until college. Pierre de Fermat, the greatest mathematician of the 17th century and the founder of the modern theory of numbers, was homeschooled. Benjamin Franklin only attended part-time school from ages 8 to 10. Robert Frost, we all know who he is, right? He, quote, disliked school so much he became physically ill. What schoolwork he did was done at home until he passed the entrance exams and entered high school. Galois, among the brightest mathematicians ever, and the founder of Galois groups and fields and Galois theory. Until age 12, Galois had no teacher but his mother. William Hamilton, the greatest Irish mathematician and the biggest contributor since Isaac Newton of mathematics to physics, was taught by his uncle, the Reverend James Hamilton. Carl Jacobi, a prominent and prolific German mathematician, was taught at home until age 12. Then we get to a controversial one. And we will go off on a tangent here a little bit. You may dispute this, but I've done a lot of research in this, and I submit that John the Apostle was homeschooled by Jesus. That Jesus picked him at a very young age, much younger than any of us think of him as, the age of perhaps 12, and picked him out partly because he was so young, and gave him the equivalent of homeschooling and taught him Christian doctrine so that he could then produce the Gospel of John. Now you're thinking, no, I've never heard this. This is really off the wall this time. Really off the wall. But then you think of a lot of incidents in the Gospels where they refer to John. There's a scene at the Last Supper where John put his head on Jesus' breast. That's the way a boy would do it to a mentor. How Jesus loved John, the apostle whom Jesus loved. That's the way a teacher loves a student. I threw this out to my class of homeschoolers to get their opinion about it. And a lot of them are Christian evangelical types, and they were very skeptical at first. But then they started coming up with other sites in the Bible that confirm that John was probably only 12 years old, and he was basically picked out for these four qualities that I talk about. Open-mindedness, and his mind is uncluttered by some of the false, misleading things that we learn. And if you think about it, if Jesus is going to hand his doctrine to someone or try to teach someone, the younger the better, as long as it's a certain age. But it's easier to teach someone who's 12 years old than it is to teach someone who's 25. By the time you're 25, you've already got a lot of preconceptions. You've already got a feeling about this world, and some of it may be incorrect, that you don't have when you're 12. And it's going to take better when you're 12. You learn languages, foreign languages, better at a young age, for example. And so one of my students says, yeah, you know what? John was a child, because there's a scene of where John raced with Peter to the tomb of Jesus. And John got there first. And a student pointed out, not only did John get there first, as you would expect a boy to outrun a man, kind of probably a heavy fisherman like Peter, not only did John get there first, but John was proud that he got there first. He wrote about it in his gospel, how the apostle whom Jesus loved outraced Peter. And he said that several times, you know, I beat him there. And then he waited. Then John waited at the tomb, which is the way a boy would wait out of respect before you go into some dark and uncertain area. And there are other examples, too. There's John's mother accompanied the apostles at times. And she said to Jesus, at one point, she said, you know, Jesus, you'll put John and my other son, James, at your right and left hand up in heaven, right? And it's just, you know, a mother would talk that way about children who are like 12 and 14. You're not going to talk that way about adult children, but your child's like 12 or 14, that's the way a mother would talk. And then at one point, John encountered some town that wasn't taking to the Christian doctrine, and it was John who said to Jesus, you know, they're not receiving us. And John says, should we just bring down fire from heaven and just kill all these people? And that's, you know, that's the way a 12-year-old boy would talk. You know, I mean, let's be done. I mean, let's just kill them all. You know, and then Jesus rebuked him, as he might rebuke a boy. So I submit that John was homeschooled, and that we got the marvelous Gospel of John because of that. And had John gone through the equivalent of the school system of that time, which would be probably training as a rabbi or whatever, he would not have taken to the doctrine as easily. He would have to unlearn some of the things he learned, and he would not have grasped it as well. One other clue that John was actually a young boy was John was there at the Passion, and nobody interrogated him. Nobody harassed him. They harassed Peter, who was an adult. But John was there the whole time to witness everything so he could record it. And he got away with that because he was a child. And nobody would care that a child was there. I mean, how else is Jesus going to have a witness when he's in the inner sanctum with Pilate and the interrogation? I mean, how is he going to do it unless he can sneak a boy in there that no one's going to care about? He's not going to get Peter in there. Peter's obviously a man. He's obviously one of his followers. He doesn't get thrown out, get crucified too. John was a 12-year-old boy. Okay, other people who are homeschooled, C.S. Lewis, taught at home by his mother and a governess until age 10. And then perhaps the most famous at all to Americans, Abraham Lincoln. His formal education was limited to a few months in a one-teacher school. That's all the formal education he got. Instead, Lincoln avidly read books such as the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and The Life of Washington. Okay, on to some generals. General Douglas MacArthur, homeschooled. Homeschooled by his mother until the age of 13 and tutored afterwards. When he entered West Point, he attained the highest entrance exam scores ever reported because he was homeschooled. And think of how he did that Incheon landing to reverse our fortunes there and help win the Korean War. That's the sort of creativity that really only a homeschooler is going to come up with. You go through the formal school system, you don't have that kind of creativity to do that daring military maneuver that General Douglas MacArthur became famous for. Okay, Wolfgang Mozart, educated by his father, who was a violinist of high repute in the service of the Archbishop of Salzburg. Blaise Pascal, one of the greatest mathematicians and philosopher of all time, homeschooled by his father. George Patton, another brilliant, insightful American general, who was the only one the Germans were really afraid of and who mastered the art of tank warfare. Taught at home until age 11, based on his father's theory of education that, quote, youthful minds should be led along a path that parallels the development of the mind by being read to by elders. So he was read to until the age of 11. Henri Poincaré, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time and one of the original developers of the theory of relativity, he was sick when he was a child. And that turned out to be a blessing to him because of his sickness. He was homeschooled. Alexander Pope, British poet, and the list goes on. Another mathematician, Bernard Riemann. Teddy Roosevelt. Roosevelt never enrolled in a public school. He was mostly instructed by private tutors until he entered Harvard College. George Bernard Shaw. Mark Twain. Frank Lloyd Wright, the brilliant architect, was taught at home by his mother, who dreamed that he would become an architect. She used, quote, Froebel's geometric blocks to entertain and educate her son. As his father led the family among various Baptist churches where he preached, Wright then attended high school but dropped out of college. He didn't graduate from college. Probably the greatest architect of all time. Brigham Young, another person who was homeschooled. So there we have a list of people who did great contributions and had great insights that benefited all of society. And they all came from homeschooling. Now, is a list of people who went through our school system, is that as good? I don't think so. I've challenged people to come up with a list of great thinkers who were educated by our school system, and they haven't come up with very many. It's a relatively short list. Now, realize, today, only about 1% to 2% of our population is homeschooled. So for there to be this level of great thinkers who were produced by homeschooling, That's a remarkably high percentage of those who are homeschooled. Now, can everybody achieve those heights? No, of course not. But as a society, isn't this something we want to encourage and expand? And even if homeschooling is not the best choice for everyone, it probably is the best choice for our society because we really benefit from the cream that rises to the top. I mean, we'll take 10,000 failures for every Thomas Edison we can get. And if homeschooling produces, makes it more likely to produce the Thomas Edison of the future, we'll take all these failures. We're better off. Thomas Edison will make up for more than 10,000 failures. So certainly I think homeschooling is essential to producing the great thinkers that we need and to cultivate our intellectual resources. Now I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about something, a way that maybe we can use our position in the homeschooling community, and I'm as a homeschool teacher. And what I've seen from this conference, from a lot of the talks, is that people are out there making scientific claims, and they're not turning over their data underlying the claims. And we've heard many speakers describe Al Gore as someone who's charitably not telling the whole truth, and the statements have gone beyond that. Why can't we get the data that's underlying the claim of these scientists? And I submit that we adopt a position that we're not going to take seriously any scientific claim where the person making it does not produce the underlying data, because there's no credibility to that. And I've made a demand on a scientist for him to produce the underlying data for a paper that he produced in the proceedings of the National Academy of Science, a relatively prestigious journal. And I requested that, based on a paper he published, I said, turn over your data. And he wouldn't do it. And so I started investigating ways to try to get that data. And if I can't get it, then I think we should just ignore the claims. Just say these claims are not credible because a scientist has not produced the underlying data to support his claims. But there are ways to get this data. And one way is that journals, including Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, has a policy that any paper that's published in it, the author has a duty to make the data available upon request. And so I'm considering going to the journal and saying, wait a minute, I requested it from this person, he hasn't given it. Now you have to take steps to uphold your policy and make sure he turns it over, or you have to exclude him from future publications. And I called them up, and I said, what should I do? And they said, first you go to the author. If he won't turn it over, then you come back to us. And I think we should start doing that. As an organization, as teachers, as many of us are, we should start making demands that these scientists who make these politically motivated claims or other claims that just seem incredible, that they turn over their data. So going to the journals is one way to do it. Going to their colleges is another way to do it. If they teach at a public college, then that college should have some sort of policy about the faculty turning over data. And perhaps some of us as teachers can make a claim for that data as teachers for educational purposes. Third way to do it is some of the sponsoring organizations, the taxpayer-funded agencies that supply money for these research with grants and so on, some of them have policies that if a researcher gets a request for data that's was developed in a publicly supported way, that the researcher has to turn that data over. So we have to look at what the grant-making institutions did, and we have to see what their policies are, and that's another way to do it. And then the fourth way is just a public campaign. A public campaign to make it clear that, wait a minute, this person is making some scientific assertions, but he hasn't turned over his data, so don't pay any attention to it. It's not credible. If he refused to turn over his underlying data, he could have made it up. Or even in the absence of fraud, it could just be flawed. He could make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. The scientist could have just made a mistake. He may have overlooked some things and so on. So I think we need to start to get tough about that. And there are various ways we can do it. And filing a lawsuit is another way. The speaker last night talked about suing Al Gore. Well, how about suing the people who are feeding scientific claims to Al Gore and suing for them to turn over their data? And if they won't do it even after a lawsuit, that should really undermine the credibility of their scientific claims. So thank you very much. On that note, I'd like to throw it open to questions.
Would you comment on the recent California proposal in law to restrict teaching to certified teachers?
The California courts know what the public school unions want, and public school unions don't want any homeschooling, or they want homeschooling limited to teachers who have certification by the state to teach. And to get this sort of certification, a teacher has to take certain courses and get indoctrinated by the state and pass certain exams and so on, and it basically cuts out true homeschooling. And all the examples I went through, it's the mother, the father, an uncle, a friend, none of these people would have been certified teachers. So if this initiative in California goes through, and if the courts adhere to their position that only certified teachers can properly instruct a student, then we're going to lose all these cases I just went through. All these examples of great thinkers who developed under true homeschooling are going to be wiped out. And as a society, do we want to lose that? Do we want to lose that contribution to our society by these great thinkers? I don't think so. Yes?
Penarth, my name. I was intrigued by your homeschooling list. I find it to be quite incomplete and a little bit confusing.
Okay.
Because you went, in many cases, to the age of 10. That's not the end of schooling. It should have gone at least to 15. You left out, for example, the prince of mathematics, Gauss, probably the person considered to be the greatest mathematician ever by the mathematicians, Leibniz, Newton's contemporary, Poincaré, whose conjectures give you a Nobel Prize today. He was not on your list.
No, he was. He was. He was homeschooled.
Oh, until when?
Well, the reason was because he was sick. He was received special instruction from his gifted mother during elementary school. He entered the lycée in 1862. Well, so he would have been homeschooled till about 8 or so.
That's very early homeschooling. You've left out a great many people who founded modern physics, beginning with Einstein, with Bohr, Born, Feynman, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and so forth. So I don't think the conclusion ought to be that homeschooling is the end and all. It is one of the great ways of training gifted people, and also gifted people can be trained through the public school system because basically gifted people train themselves.
Well, that's a challenging comment. I'd like to respond to that, though, by looking at the qualities that a great thinker has to have. And I including that open-mindedness, self-starter, and the time and energy to pursue his skill. And the public school system has expanded over time. And as I gave the example of the mathematician, where in the current system, mathematician doesn't start contributing until he's age 25. And no one on your list except for Gauss was a mathematician.
And Leibniz was a mathematician.
Well, Leibniz, okay, I don't know about the case of Leibniz. I have to look into that. You may be right about Leibniz. So maybe he had two people, but I must have had 8 or 10.
I had 10 physicists.
Well, the physicists, okay, it's like, does a mathematician beat a physicist? Okay, I play a mathematician, you play a physicist. I'll have to look into those examples. I mean, do you know that the physicists you listed went through the public school system or went through the school system?
I do not know, but they were not mentioned by you.
They were not mentioned by me. I will investigate that. That's an excellent point. Thank you.
Eric Palmer from Tucson, Arizona. I love and appreciate the emphasis you've placed on mathematicians, having just a little insight into the difficulty, the challenge it is for a young person in today's culture to put enough into his career to become a mathematician. I work for an employer that hires 5,000 engineers in one spot, and they have become concerned about where they're going to get the next generation of engineers. And so they have initiated a program in the high schools called Math Moves You. They go into the schools and they promote the study of mathematics. When this was announced, I wrote to the CEO of my company, and I suggested to him that his effort might be more productive if he would campaign with the state to do away with the lottery so that these children could go home from school and be under the influence of parents who are not paying a dollar for a lottery ticket that has 25 cents value of expectation. That kind of influence in mathematics in the home, in the long run, will have a more leavening influence on society, I thought. I was fortunate not to lose my job over that. But the CEO did write back to me, and in a very condescending way and with a lot of misspellings, explained that he disagreed.
Well, the student in today's school system has a long day. For the average public schools student, it's a matter of waking up at 7 a.m., catching some bus somewhere, going off to a school, taking courses all throughout the day in a variety of topics, some of that are not terribly intellectual. Then you get home, you've got to deal with things at public school, you have to deal with distractions. I was shocked to learn that every day there are 160,000 students in our country who stay at home from public school because they're afraid of getting beaten up in public school. Every day, 160,000 students are so afraid of going to school, they stay at home. It's an environment that I don't think is terribly receptive to the great thinker. In fact, many school systems today, they discourage taking courses above your grade level. They've even put restrictions on taking courses above your grade level. So if you're a math prodigy and you're in seventh grade and you want to learn calculus, you're not going to get that from our school system. And so should our school system be designed to herd through the average person, or should we change focus and say, wait a minute, the average is not going to be the group that really contributes to our society. Our system should be designed towards the superstars. Forget about the average. We should have a system that enables the great mathematicians to develop with greater frequency than they have been. Yes?
My name's Tom Gatliff again. All three of my daughters went through public school. None of them were ever discouraged from taking higher classes. All of them were identified as children that they had higher than average IQs, considerably higher. All three of them, in fact, spent their high school years taking high school courses in the morning and state-paid college classes in the afternoon. When they were starting in school, her mother and I, their mothers and I, had many a conference with teachers, not explaining why or how our children were acting, but instead explaining to the teachers what our children were telling them. And how they, I know the first time my daughter came back from first grade with a test, she said, the teacher marked this wrong. Well, it was clear the teacher didn't understand what my daughter knew.
Uh-huh.
But what I point out is it's not necessary for a child to be homeschooled to be great. It is necessary for the parents to be involved with that children's education, whether it's in educating themselves in homeschool or in taking an active part in making sure they receive a good and proper education from the public school system. And one of the greatest drawbacks today is the number of parents who are so engaged in other work simply because they can't afford to live otherwise without both of them working all the time. And when their evening comes, they have so little time, they can't spend time with their children reading to them, which is essential for a child to learn language. That's part of our problem right now is the fact that the society itself is not set up to properly involve the parents with their children's education. That's the essence of homeschooling, and the real benefit from it is that the parents are involved with the child's education, and if the parents are involved with the child's education, it doesn't matter where the child gets educated, they receive the benefit of that parental involvement. And that's just my humble opinion.
Well,
based on my experience.
No, I think you make many excellent points, but I would disagree with you that a parent can provide the kind of education to a child if the child is enrolled in public school. It's not that easy.
No,
the public school day is exhausting to a child.
That's not my point. The point is, all those qualities you mentioned about the child that in the beginning, those evolve from the fact the child knows the parent is with them, working with them, and involved with them, and cares more about them. That's the thing that many children are missing right now.
I think you're right. Many children are missing that.
Yeah.
But that
was my point.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I would just caution, some public schools have gotten so bad that even the best of parents are not going to be able to overcome the bad culture that kid encounters in public school. Now, you may have had a good public school with your children. It may have been, 10, 20 years ago. But, there are good parents who lose their kids despite their best efforts because their kid falls into a culture in the public school, gets exhausted by the end of the day. I mean, after a kid goes through all that, it's like 8 o'clock at night. Are you going to start teaching your kid calculus? I mean, the kid's exhausted from going through it. You can't, and you look at what the great mathematicians are doing today. I mean, I just went through. The guy who's the greatest contest mathematician, he was homeschooled. And if you can compete against that guy, I mean, you may do pretty well at public school. You can do above average. But if you're going to compete against this guy is homeschooled. This guy is got 100% into his math, and he doesn't have the distraction of having to sit through, sex ed in public school. Yeah.
You've been emphasizing the science in the homeschooling, but on your conservapedia.com, I notice that you every week have a new masterpiece of art right on the front.
Yeah.
Would you comment about your, what do you call it, a website? It's competing with Wikipedia very well.
Thank you, Dr. Long. I have started with my homeschool students. They really helped me start this. Conservapedia.com, which is competition with Wikipedia. It's conservative combined with the word encyclopedia, Conservapedia. And it's designed to give students an alternative resource that does not have all the liberal bias of Wikipedia. And my site is friendlier to homeschool students and friendlier to the conservative ideology, and it takes out a lot of the liberal bias. And there are people who are hostile to homeschooling, and this site clears that out and signals some of the triumphs of homeschooling. Here's another example, the guy who won the Heisman Trophy, even in sports now, Tim Tebow, he was homeschooled right to college. And then he won the Heisman Trophy as the best college athlete of the year in football. But you don't hear that. You don't hear many of these examples. That's sort of taken out of the press stories. The masterpiece of the week is designed to give art, expose these kids to art that they wouldn't see on other in public school or other sources. Yes?
My name is Diana Paradise, and I have a question for you. Do you feel that in the public schools that the integration of children with special ed needs into the mainstreaming into the classroom has deterred the high achievers from being able to move forward as quickly as they could or from being motivated to do so?
I think that's possible. I mean, public schools are a one-size-fits-all approach. And that's great, sir, that your daughters were never held back, but some public schools are short on resources. And when they're short on resources, they start to cut off the accelerated path that the gifted children need, and they start to devote their resources to the lowest common denominator. It's perhaps an implied way of putting it, but public schools is really about teaching to the average rather than teaching to the very best. And some public schools are running out of money. I mean, the Detroit public schools are broke. They don't have the money to go for the gifted children, which is what our society cares about. We want as many gifted children as possible. Instead, they have to teach to the average or the students who are struggling.
Well, I worked for several years for special ed. I worked in the administrative offices for our school system. And actually, having had some learning problems myself, I am grateful that there are those things available. However, I did see from my gifted friends and their children that oftentimes they would get disgruntled and do that acting out behavior, the very thing you were talking about. And the teachers are so overwhelmed with trying to deal with all these things. And the children that are slow definitely need more help and oftentimes feel excluded socially because they are in that position. I mean, it's really a catch-22, you know. They get excluded in other ways, but in these positions, there's so much stress put on them that, in my opinion, it would be much better to let the gifted kids commiserate together and in some way maybe give them the opportunity to gain compassion, but the other children to be put in places where they can learn have a more amenable environment for learning as well.
I think those are excellent points, but I would just add that as a society, what we benefit the most from is developing the greatest resource and developing the great thinkers. And we all are compassionate, and that's good, but it's like drilling for oil. You want to hit the oil that's going to give you the best well. And same thing, when we design our school system, don't we want to design it for the top as a society? Aren't we better off as a society if we design it for the top? Thank you very much.